really appreciated. It would not have been a particularly perfect journal club with me just getting back from Korea a few hours before it started. I'm just now starting to get a full night's sleep, I think, so still a little bit on the jet lag train there. So I'll share my screen. And start with our first article. As I was explaining before, folks may have joined for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. It was a particularly slim or skim month for pulmonary pathology journals across the literature. We really, Philip, our fellow who's co-presenting with me, who I'll formally introduce in just a second, in just a few minutes, when we do his article. We had a real time finding good articles that were relevant and that we thought would be good for discussion among the group. But we scraped the barrel and we did come up with a few. Unfortunately, there'll only be three that we're talking about today. But we'll invite the conversation and we'll do the best we can in the hopes of a better tomorrow with a better next month for pulmonary pathology articles. So, without further ado, the first article that we're going to discuss is coming to us from Korea, as it were, and it's entitled The Prognostic Impact of Extracapsular Extension of Lymph Nodes in Resected Lung Cancer, an Analysis of New N Subcategories and Histologic Type. It's by first author Yura An and colleagues. And in this article, or in this study, the authors set out to evaluate the prognostic import of extracapsular extension, defined as a tumor spreading beyond the lymph node capsule, something that's now, of course, recognized as an R1 descriptor by the IASLC staging guidelines. We all know the completeness of surgical resection is a cornerstone of the prognosis of non-small cell lung cancer and certainly influences adjuvant therapy decisions. And so this was deemed as a pretty important topic by this group. They also start out in their paper by talking a bit about some of the work that's already been done and the fact that there's been some conflicting analysis on the prognostic import of extracapsular extension, which they aimed to clarify by this study. So they note the inconsistent associations between extracapsular extension and outcomes, specifically overall survival and recurrence-free survival, particularly when you stratify it by the N subcategories, as well as histologic type. They also wanted to evaluate it by the different types of non-small cell lung cancer. They specifically looked at adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma speciated out, and again, looked at that prognostic value of extracapsular extension. They did this in a retrospective fashion at their center, and so they took a retrospective cohort over a 12-year period, and they looked at patients who had pathologically confirmed node-positive disease who had undergone lobectomy or pneumonectomy with an R0 resection. They excluded anyone with R1 or R2 resections, prior malignancies within 5 years, neoadjuvant therapy, individuals without follow-up, or individuals who had synchronous cancers defined by cancer developing any time along the course of their follow-up period. Extracapsular extension was defined as any tumor extension into the perinodal adipose tissue or desmoplastic tissue outside of the lymph or in continuation of the lymph node into those extracapsular areas. The outcomes that were evaluated, as I previously mentioned, their primary endpoints were overall survival and recurrence-free survival. And then they also looked in a secondary fashion at the patterns of recurrence, like local, regional, or distant recurrence. The statistics they used were perfectly appropriate. They used Cox proportional hazards and fine-grained models for survival and recurrence pattern. Those are pretty standard for bioepidemiological studies, of course, these days. And they did multivariate adjustment for age, sex, TN categories, histology, and adjuvant therapy. So I'll go to their flow diagram, which I thought was particularly helpful. I love when they include these in the methodologies. They started off with a little over 8,500 patients, as you see there, over their 12-year period. They pulled out all the people with N1 or N2 diseases, as you see there. They had to exclude 700, just a little over 700 patients because they were R1 or R2, or they had other malignancies or all those other exclusionary criteria that I talked about. So they wound up looking at just a shade over 1,700 individuals in their final study population. They stratified them out into PN1, PN2A, and PN2B categories, and then evaluated for extracapsular extension histologically accordingly. And you see how those play out across their study. All right, so that was their overall methodology. What about their results? Well, they noted that extracapsular extension was associated with increased nodal burden. So individuals with higher end stage tended to have more extracapsular extension. I think that sort of makes sense probably to most of us, because I think most of us were under the assumption that extracapsular extension was certainly going to be associated or portended a more aggressive course. What they did also find was that it was an independent predictor of worse overall survival and recurrence-free survival across all those end categories. And again, not entirely surprising given what I said just a moment ago. The negative prognostic impact, however, was, I think, somewhat interestingly restricted to adenocarcinoma, meaning that for squamous cell carcinoma, extracapsular extension did not seem to have. Did not seem to portend the negative prognostic import that it did for the adenocarcinoma category. And so that I think is somewhat novel and probably the more interesting part of this study, because again, the rest of this stuff in terms of the value of extracapsular extension has been pretty well established in the literature, even in light of the fact that, as the authors point out, there was some conflicting data on this topic. Extracapsular extension was also significantly increased with local regional recurrence, but it was not so with distant recurrence. Postoperative radiotherapy in extracapsular extension positive patients was also associated with reduced local regional occurrence, particularly in the adenocarcinoma group. Again, it wasn't really shown in the squamous group. No difference in extracapsular extension between the histologic subtypes within the adenocarcinoma group as well. So that I think is also interesting. Here, shown on the screen for individuals that can see it, are the survival curves showing extracapsular extension and no extracapsular extension. I think these graphs are pretty clear and again, not out of not off the page in terms of what we would have necessarily anticipated or expected based on what we know about that finding. So that's the major take-home points for this paper and kind of their major findings. It has a number of strengths associated with it. Certainly, this is a large single-center institutional cohort with pretty rigorous multivariate analysis. These individuals were, by virtue of both the fact that it's single institution and because of their exclusionary criteria, similarly treated, which again is an important point for retrospective cohorts. The histologically stratified analysis does kind of hold up and appear to be robust in this work. It is limited also by the fact that it is a single center, and so it's always in question whether single center material can be generalizable to broader populations. So that's just kind of an inherent design associated limitation. Also, given the fact that we know that somewhat the cancer of lung cancer has certainly changed over the 12-year period, there are going to be differences in chemotherapeutic cocktail and a whole host of things that are also going to potentially play in to some of these survival curves that you kind of need to be aware of as well. So again, the biggest take-home point of this is that extracapsular extension is something that's important. It is something we need to be calling out on reports. And again, I think that's clear based on the ISLC staging parameters with the R status that ECE is part of. We also know now that it does not appear to be the fact that all extracapsular extension is the same, and there is some dependence on a tumor type, with it being seemingly more important in adenocarcinoma, at least when compared to squamous cell carcinoma in the lung. So we'll open up this article for discussion and kind of get people's thoughts on it.
Joe, I'm sorry, I joined a few minutes late. Did they go into the definition of how they define ECE, and specifically how difficult it might be to assess that in fragmented lymph nodes, since we're frequently getting these lobectomies and staging procedures are done with the scope, and so we're often seeing torn apart lymph nodes, not beautiful intact lymph nodes.
Yeah, it's a great question, Jen. And so they basically used two factors. One was into perinodal fat, or extracapsular fat, which is clear only, as you point out, when you have intact lymph nodes. So the other thing that they used was a desmoplastic response, which does have inherent subjectivities to it as well. But that's really what they were using there. So when the nodes are fragmented or anything like that, if they saw a desmoplastic or a fibroblastic response in association with the tumor cells in fat, there was an assumption that those were extracapsular extension. At least that's what I could parse from their methodology.
I was wondering the same thing, specifically since they don't even have a picture in there.
Correct.
There is not a single microscopic picture that shows that. And I'm worried about that too. I mean, I'm trying to look for this extra nodal extension now more carefully, but I'm not sure how good we really are in picking them up, specifically in the lymph nodes that do not come with the lobectomy specimen.
Yeah, both excellent points, of course. So I do think that is a limitation here. It would have been nice to see that, but given that it was published in Lung Cancer, kind of not a primary pathology journal, I suspect the reviewers didn't really ask or demand that of the authors, which I think is a little bit unfortunate. Paper would have been strengthened by some pictures that showed that, specifically because I think this was meant to be providing guidance to pathologists. So certainly would have given them a little bit more weight, I think, from the pathology side.
Luckily, we don't have that many positive lymph nodes, because we're going to be getting a lot of questions from our frozen section lab about this.
Other thoughts, comments?
I will say, comparing to the head and neck, where we actually get big, easily identifiable lymph nodes, where you actually have a little bit of tissue around them, they're intact and stuff, even there, the inter-observer variability is kind of in the moderate range in terms of agreement. So this, I agree, it would definitely be harder in this situation.
I'm actually not aware of any study that assesses inter-observer variability or inter-observer agreement for extracapsular extension in lung cancer. That, if somebody's looking for a trainee looking for a project or something, that might be an interesting project, even something that we could do in our journal club here across institutions, get internal variability or internal agreement in our institutions, and then also seek multi-institutional agreement. It would be probably something that'd be worthwhile to do, given that this appears to be a parameter that's gaining some steam and rising to the top. Maybe it would also help get some better
articles.
Even in
the head and neck, I, as a non-head and neck pathologist, I frequently feel like I'm making it up, or I have to ask, which is just never a good feeling. And I'm glad that somebody can assess this in a manner that is prognostically significant, but I don't know, when you turn it loose on the pathology community in general, I guess I have concerns about how this is going to perform.
Yeah, warranted, I think. All right, any other comments? All right, hearing none, we'll move on to our second paper. I'll go ahead and share that one next. Here we go. All right. So if you liked the last topic, you're sure to like this one as well, because we're along the same bioepidemiologic lines of prognostic import in histologic findings. That's sort of the theme of these two papers that I'm talking about today. And this one addresses the prognostic impact of lipidic growth in intermediate and high-grade lung cancers. And so when I read this, I think my first impression, at least, was that, like, this is this really a topic that we needed to look carefully at? I guess that's just never the thing that comes first to my mind in driving the prognosis in individuals who have intermediate or high-grade lung cancer. It's not how much of the lipidic growth is there and whether or not that impacts things. But they wanted to take a look at this, and so, you know, who am I to judge? But after reading their paper and kind of seeing all the work that they did, and I think you'll find that I think some of my initial impressions were probably right. All right, so we'll go ahead and jump in. Again, this is a German group. Dr. Niedermeyer and colleagues were the ones who did this. And they set off in their introduction here by explaining to us that lung cancer is, of course, a heterogeneous disease. There's mixed growth patterns that have been described, and there's some prognostic value and prognostic import that has been assigned to those growth patterns over the coming years, which is why those have taken kind of such a strong foothold in grading, as well as the WHO classification of lung adenocarcinoma. They then go on to lay out what lipidic growth means. Tumor cells, of course, growing along pre-existing alveoli without stromal, vascular, or pleural invasion. And they note that that does, in general, especially when it's restricted to that type of growth, convey a favorable prognosis to patients with that growth type. They use the ISLC's grading system, the 2021 one, grade one, lipidic predominant with less than 20% high grade patterns, grade two, acinar or papillary predominant without high risk features, and then grade three, more than 20% high grade solid micropapillary or complex glandular. Prognostic significance of the non-predominant lipidic growth in grade 2 to 3 tumors is what they were targeting with their study. And so they were looking at those grade 2 or 3s where they had the lipidic growth pattern. And they were citing some previous Asian cohorts where they suggested that non-predominant lipidic growth in those tumors imparted a favorable prognosis to individuals. So they set out to do a similar thing in a European patient cohort. They looked at individuals with stage 1 disease, grades 2 or 3, non-mucinous lung adenocarcinoma. So their design was a single center retrospective design. They looked at 479 patients with resected stage 1, grade 2 to 3 non-mucinous adenocarcinoma. They excluded all grade 1, the mucinous enteric colloid types, and they excluded individuals who had had prior adjuvant or neoadjuvant chemotherapy because they didn't want to have that impact of that therapy on the higher grade proportions, given that the proportions were important to their overall study design. Growth patterns were quantified in 5% increments, and again, by that WHO classification that I talked about before. They assessed for pleural invasion with elastic stains, but otherwise they were looking at H&E for all the other parameters. They looked at overall survival and recurrence-free survival, similar to the last study, and again, they used a multivariable Cox regression model and then looked at Kaplan-Meier survival curves as well, which we'll take a look at in just a few minutes. What they found, a 5-year overall survival of 83% with the lipidic positive and 81% with the lipidic negative, and 5-year recurrence-free survival at 74% for the lipidic positive tumors and 71% versus the lipidic negative. So not a big difference in either of those groups. And their statistics bore that out with no statistically significant survival differences between the groups. Stratifying by the percent of lipidic growth, 1 to 10% versus those that were over 10% did not appear to change this result. So they tried to simplify and dichotomize, and that had no impact. Independent prognostic factors, that they saw a worse overall survival with age, male sex, solid growth, all things that have been previously established, and they saw worse recurrence-free survival, again, with age, stage 1B, grade 3, or lymphatic invasion. No surprises there. Lipidic growth did not appear to impact multivariate analysis. So somewhat of a negative study in some ways. The lipidic growth was not shown to have a prognostic significance at all in grade 2 or 3 lung adenocarcinomas. Rather, the prognosis was more strongly driven by the invasive high-grade pattern, stage, age, and whether or not there was lymphovascular invasion. They concluded that the lipidic growth in grade 2 or 3 did not impact or predict overall survival, and so that they their closing recommendations were really that the focus should remain on identifying high-grade invasive components for pathologists like solid micropapillary or complex glandular. Histologic grading remains more clinically relevant than trying to assess and quantify the lipidic proportion, particularly in these advanced grades that they were studying. And again, maybe this just reflects more of my naivete about some of the nuances of these things, but it's just not something that I would have necessarily been keen to be digging deep into. But maybe you guys have had some experiences that would have made you want to look more carefully at this question. So with that said, there were some limitations, very similar to the last one in terms of the single center and the retrospective nature of it, but there are obviously also upsides to that as well. And with that, I'll gladly open up this paper for further conversation.
Well, I'm glad about this outcome because otherwise we would have to change the the grading.
Yeah, so while not surprising, I guess it is reassuring in that, on that front. True. Other thoughts about this? All right. For our third paper, I'm going to turn it over to our wonderful fellow this year, Dr. Philip Hurst. I don't think everybody's had the opportunity to meet him yet, but he's joining us here today in Rochester. Philip is a fantastic fellow, fantastic pulmonary fellow. We've had the great fortune of having him do two fellowships here. He did a fellowship in cardiovascular pathology and then one in pulmonary pathology. So he is really filling out the thorax there, and we're going to be excited to have him as a Mayo colleague next year when he takes a staff position down in Jacksonville. So without further ado, I'll hand the microphone over to Philip for a discussion of our third article. Philip.
Thank you, Dr. Malcheski. Do you want me to share my screen? I didn't know.
Sure.
If you... Okay, perfect. I'll pull up the...
If you can, can you? If not,
yes.
I can make you...
I think so. Here. Let me see.
Okay.
Okay, yep, looks like that should work. Okay, so I looked into this article about acquired SMARCA4 alterations by a group out of Brigham and Women's with Dr. Gagne and Scholl. And basically, they had an index case where they found a 70-year-old woman who had a history of minimally invasive adenocarcinoma that subsequently progressed, became metastatic, and they were able to find, after doing molecular on both specimens from before and after the metastasis, that this lady had developed a SMARCA4 mutation after her original treatment. And so they decided to look more into whether or not the acquisition of a SMARCA4 alteration could represent progression of a non-small cell lung carcinoma. And so just as a little bit of background, as we all I'm sure probably know, SMARCA4 encodes a catalytic subunit of the Sui-SNF chromatin remodeling complex, and they've been seen as kind of definitional mutations in some other cancer types, such as the hypercalcemic type of small cell carcinomas of the ovary, uterine undifferentiated carcinomas, and the Sui-SNF complex deficient sinonasal carcinomas. We know that now, since the WHO 2021 edition, that we can also see them in thoracic tumors, in the SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated thoracic tumors. But we also know that we've seen them in other, we've seen loss of SMARCA4 in other non-small cell carcinomas of the lung. So the question then became after this index case, could SMARCA4 acquisition signify progression of non-small cell lung cancer? And so for their cohort, they at Brigham and Women's, they found, they looked for patients that had diagnoses of non-small cell lung carcinoma and then that had multiple molecular samples between the years 2013 and 2022. And they compared, they looked at their demographic information, the histologic and immunohistochemical findings, and they compared it to their molecular profiles from before and after treatment or before and after multiple specimens were acquired. They looked at NGS by OncoPanel, and they assessed for clonality, tumoral burden, and mutational signatures, and then they compared all of this, as I already mentioned, with the histology and IHC. So, so what they found, and you can see the flow diagram down here, is that they had a total of 4,154 patients with non-small cell lung cancer diagnoses. And then when they looked for patients that had multiple samples, they found 354 that they deemed to be clonally related, so having similar driver mutations, then of those 354, seven showed acquisition of a SMARCA4 alteration after their initial diagnosis. So that represented about 2% of the 354 that had some SMARCA4 alterations. The median age for these individuals, for these seven individuals, was 60. 50% of them were women, 71% were never smokers. And histologically, for their primary diagnosis, six of them were adenocarcinomas and one was pleomorphic. And then we'll talk a little bit more about how those may have changed over time, but median time between the samples, so the original diagnosis and then the subsequent development of a SMARCA4 mutation, was 419 days. So six out of seven of these individuals had oncogenic drivers. And then, so this is the findings after the development of the SMARCA4 mutation. Six of seven had oncogenic drivers. Two of seven had APO-BEC signatures. And six out of seven showed biallelic inactivation. When looking at the immunohistochemistry, all of the original samples had retained expression of BRG1. And after the SMARCA4 mutation acquisition, two of five, as you can see here, not all seven patients had material sufficient for evaluation of IHC. Two of the five that did showed loss of BRG expression, and they did trend to losing TTF1 and NAPCIN expression and tended to gain SOX2 expression. So overall, the acquired SMARCA4 mutations are rare. They may be seen in the context of truncal or early events in the disease progression. They're more likely to be found, based on this small sample, in older non-smoking women, which is in contrast to what we see in SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumors, which tend to be younger smoking men. And then these acquired SMARCA4 mutations were more likely to be associated with increasing tumoral mutation burden and the APO-BEC mutagenesis. Protein loss, as evaluated by IHC, was more commonly seen in biallelic mutations, and so you might not have the loss of the BRG expression otherwise, even with a SMARCA4 alteration identified genetically. And then as I mentioned, so there was some progression in, they looked at the morphologic differences. And so a lot of these people, well, not a lot, I mean, of the seven that they looked at, the early samples tended to show lower or moderately differentiated adenocarcinomas. And then a smaller subset of them did show kind of morphologic progression where they developed the more sheet-like growth of the discohesive cells, some with rhabdoid features like we commonly see in SMARCA4 undifferentiated tumors, but that was not across the board. Importantly, while this is interesting and in an area of investigation for the purposes of treatments, because we know that SMARCA4 individuals often might not respond well to immunotherapy, there are other targets, SMARCA4 degraders that people are working on that may be of interest in people who develop these alterations later in their disease course. Of course, as already mentioned, there are limitations to this study. There were only 7 patients that they looked at, which might have also been limited by selection bias in terms of which patients had had multiple specimens taken, and then just the limited material in general for being able to reevaluate for morphology and immunohistochemistry, et cetera. So interesting case, but something that I think will probably require more follow-up over time as we see more progression in these individuals. Awesome. Happy to discuss.
Open it up for discussion.
Yeah.
I have a question. That some of the cases have the protein loss, some of them does not.
Yeah.
So theoretically, SMARCA4 deficient is defined as like protein loss because we know if it's heterozygous mutation, it may not have effect on a tumor suppressor gene. So do they compare the difference between those protein loss and retain? Do they have different prognosis?
I don't think that they
did. I know the number is small, but...
Yeah, very small, yeah. Let me see which one of these. I don't think they did. I mean, they made a comment about it in the discussion for the biallelic inactivation, but I don't think they made any comments about the specific distinction between prognosis between the two.
Yeah, because like right now we recognize those SMARCA4 thoracic SMARCA4 undifferentiated tumor, but on the histology side, we should see a good histology and evidence of protein loss. On the molecular side, I know sometimes people got too excited when they see one SMARCA4 mutation, could be a passenger mutation, mm-hmm. and the molecular pathology lab may jump into that and call it a SMARCA4 deficient tumor, which is just a non-small cell with a heterozygous passenger SMARCA4 mutation. So I would like to see that difference be discussed or compared because it may have very different biological meaning.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I'm seeing where they discuss the biallelic alterations versus heterozygosity, and it does not seem like they went any further than that in terms of outcomes. But that's a great point.
All right. Well, if there's no other comments on this article, I'll just make brief mention of a few other things that were in the literature during the month of August that are probably worthy of just a quick mention. There was sort of an interesting editorial in the New England Journal that's worth just a quick glance. It was basically talking about the shift in approach for resectable lung cancers, moving from surgery with postoperative chemo to a more perioperative strategy in chemo early on prior to resection, as well as after in the setting of resected lung cancers, and kind of a move to that really representing a new era for lung cancer treatment. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that the editorial does spend a fair amount of time mentioning the fact that the use of PCR and cell-free tumor DNA really need to be more widely available and probably a more common thing as surrogate endpoints in future studies if we're going to be critically evaluating these more personalized approaches to treatment in lung cancer. So I think that was worthy of mention. There was quite a bit this month, interestingly enough, on pulmonary hypertension. A lot of it was more clinical or basic disease mechanisms, which are interesting, but probably not relevant to many of us. So I kind of resisted the urge to talk about those, even though that's my natural inclination, as many of you know, because I do like pulmonary hypertension very much. The one that I think was most interesting in there was talking about the role of the FANCL gene in both pulmonary arterial hypertension as well as pulmonary veno-occlusive disease. That's been a gene that's been of a lot of interest lately in pulmonary hypertension broadly. And I think kind of the article, which really focused on some of the biology of pulmonary hypertension, really talked about needing to further exploit the TGF-beta pathway and some emerging data that shows that the TGF-beta pathway is probably of therapeutic import when we're dealing with cases of primary pulmonary hypertension or PVOD. And so there's kind of a common pathway there, which I thought was sort of interesting. So again, just a few neat articles on pulmonary vascular disease, if that's something that you're inclined to be interested in. Aside from that, like I said, just another small handful of articles. It was a pretty skimpy month. Hopefully September will be a little bit better, will fare better for pulmonary pathology. Any other last minute comments, concerns, points of information or interest or otherwise? All right, everyone. Well, thanks for joining. And again, I appreciate the rescheduling. And thanks to Philip for your help with this journal club.
Thanks, Joe and Philip. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
See y'all.
Thank you.
See you.